Good morning. I'm Cal Winslow, your host, and this morning, welcome back to our series, Where Are We Now? Our purpose is to examine some of our most urgent concerns, climate change, international conflict, gender, race, and inequality, and the state of the Earth's resources, especially now as we enter this period of transition. Our guest this morning is Professor Michael Watts. He is Professor Emeritus in Geography at the University of California in Berkeley. Professor Watts received his bachelor's degree in Geography from University College London and his PhD from the University of Michigan. His PhD work was on agrarian change and politics in northern Nigeria and was published as Silent Violence in 1983. He joined the faculty of the Geography Department at UC Berkeley in 1979 and served from 1994 to 2004 as director of the Institute of International Studies. He's a member of the Retort Collective, a Bay Area-based collective of radical intellectuals with whom he authored the book Afflicted Powers, Capital and Spectacle in a New Age of War. Professor Watts is also on the advisory board of Faculty for Israeli-Palestinian Peace, USA, a network of Palestinian, Israeli, and international faculty and students working for an end to the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories and for a just peace. He was a Guggenheim Fellow for his research on oil politics. He was awarded the Victoria Medal of the Royal Geographical Society. He served as a fellow of the Center for Advanced Study in Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University. Professor Watts is also the author of many books and many more articles, and the books include Genealogies of Environmental Thought, Oil Talk, The Secret Lives of the Oil and Gas Industry, Global Political Economy. His new chapter in the collection River of Fire, Commons, Crisis, and the Imagination is in part homage to his late friend, the Nigerian environmentalist and political activist, Oronto Douglas. He co-edited West of Eden, Communes and Utopia in Northern California, a book whose origins are to be found in investigations of the experiences of 1970s communards here in Mendocino County. Finally, he and his family, as well as many of his students, have been frequent visitors to our county. So with that, good morning, Professor Watts. Michael, can I call you Michael?
Good morning, Cal. Good to be with you.
Okay. Well, Michael, let's start with this. Nigeria. You've really kind of spent a lifetime with Nigeria. Can you tell us how that came about?
Well, as is often the case, Cal, with these things, the short answer is serendipity. I went up to study at University College London in the 1960s, and when I was finished, when I graduated, I wanted to work abroad. I'd been sort of radicalized in London, and I wanted to work abroad, and it was all set, in fact, to spend some time. And then the nonprofit group I was intending to work with had to suddenly cancel the project, largely because of the outbreak of war between Pakistan and India. So in desperation, I was looking around for a place to go, and ultimately I had the opportunity to go to Nigeria, the north of Nigeria, and was involved in various things there in the early 1970s. I was teaching. I did some work building schools and so on, and it was really that experience which sort of, in a way, changed my life, in part because I was there in the early 1970s, Cal, when there was you're old enough like me to remember this, the great famines of West Africa in the late 60s and early 1970s, and I was there during that period, and that's really what got me interested in that part of the world and in questions of food and famine, and that sort of brought me back to graduate school.
I see. And so in graduate school, was there something in particular that you decided to look at?
Well, I actually came back to graduate school, Cal, to pursue these interests. I mean, what I saw when I was living and working in, this was mostly rural northern Nigeria. This is a semi-arid area, as you know, and it's a region that in which drought is endemic. Rainfall is highly variable. Agriculture, rain-fed agriculture, is risky at the best of times. And there had been a run of bad drought years. This, of course, was long before we were talking about global climate change in the 60s and 70s. There was a run of drought years, harvest failed, and hundreds of thousands of people across the region, not only in Nigeria, died of starvation. And I came back to study that because when I was there, even though people were starving, everywhere I went, even in quite remote communities, there was always food to be had in the marketplace. There was never an absolute scarcity of food. It was rather that people couldn't afford to buy it. So it was that paradox, in a way. Why could you have, seemingly in the heart of a famine or a subsistence crisis, why could you have food available, but people starving? And the people that were starving, of course, were not the people in the cities, but were the people that were growing the food, namely the peasants. I was working in peasant communities in across northern Nigeria at that time. So that's what really brought me back, Cal, to graduate school. And I, for, again, serendipitous reasons, ended up in the Midwest in Ann Arbor, which, again, as you well know, was a center of sort of radicalism, both during the anti-war movement. But more generally, as I recall, there was a Marxist mayor when I arrived in Ann Arbor. And it had certain sorts of affinities with the Bay Area and Berkeley in particular, so I felt very at home there, and it was a wonderful place to explore these sorts of ideas.
Okay. Thinking about Michigan today, what a difference. Anyway, Michael, so from there to oil. Now, you've written a lot and thought a lot about oil, so let's jump over to the politics of oil then and your interest in that, and to what degree you think this is still important. I mean, we're now thinking about global change, global climate change, the issues of war and peace, war still raging in the Middle East. We've got Rex Tillerson as our Secretary of State. What about the politics of oil?
That's right. And not only Tillerson, of course, but if you look at the head of EPA, Scott Pruitt, for example, there's a number of people in the administration who, in a sense, come out of the oil and gas industry and or have defended the oil and gas industry. And as you well know, one of the major the thrusts of the major Trump administration is obviously a type of environmental rollback, and that's going to be particularly a rollback of environmental regulations that pertain to the oil and gas industry. So in a way, even though we had this discussion, I remember talking to you, Cal, during the Bush eras, as it were, when there was also a sense that, as Mike Davis once put it, that the oil and gas industry was back then had occupied the White House. I think this is even more the case now, actually, and quite nakedly so. So I think the oil and gas question, and particularly Trump's apparent commitment to expanding not only coal production but hydrocarbons generally, means that oil politics, broadly put, is absolutely front and central on the agenda. So, yes, I think that it's not going to go away. Quite the reverse, and my involvement with it sort of came from not the global north end so much, but from the global south, and Nigeria, which we were just talking about, of course, is known to probably most of your listeners as a major oil producer. And in fact, when I went to Nigeria first, a long, long time ago, that oil production was just beginning. And oil was then important, but had not really come to dominate the economy. Of course, now, 40 years on or so, something like 85% of government revenues come from oil. 95-98% of exports in Nigeria come from oil, and a very significant proportion of the economy, the gross domestic product, comes from oil. So it's very much an oil state. So my work in Nigeria increasingly had to come to terms with the impact of that oil dependency, if you like, on the economy. And that's a big and complicated story, but there's a whole body of work. Again, I know you know this, Cal, but there's a body of work that's often called the resource curse that tries to explain the apparent paradox of why it is that so many seemingly oil-rich states, could be Venezuela, could be Saudi Arabia, could be Angola, why is it that so many oil-rich states underperform in developmental terms? That's to say that their economies, outside of just the fluctuations in the economy which are driven by oil prices, generally speaking, economic growth is poor, and that in a number of human development arenas, education, life expectancy, schooling, and so on, these oil-producing states, and Nigeria is absolutely no exception, tends to underperform. So I wanted to explore then why it was that Nigeria is probably now pocketed, since, say, 1970, $1 trillion of oil revenues that the Nigerian state has captured. And why is it that, 40, 50 years on now, living standards, life expectancy in Nigeria is about 50 years? And why is it that standards of living and the incidence of poverty is pretty much the same now as it was at the beginning of the oil boom? So that's the type of oil politics I was trying to explore.
So I guess I should ask, Mike, about would you posit an answer to your question?
Yeah, so I suppose, again, the short answer would be this, that obviously when oil-producing states, and again, all oil-producing states typically do the same sort of thing in terms of trying to control their oil wealth. What they do is, and this is as true as I say, in Venezuela or Angola or Russia for that matter, what they do is they nationalize subsurface mineral rights. That's to say they nationalize control of oil. They set up a national oil company. In Nigeria, it's the Nigerian National Oil Company. In Venezuela, it's PDVSA. In other countries, different national oil companies. And those oil companies then work with the majors, Chevron, Agip, Shell, etc., in what are called joint ventures to explore and produce oil. That's the nature of the arrangement, and what that arrangement means is that the state concerned is able to capture a significant proportion of the value of every barrel of oil produced. And generally speaking, that's about 80 cents on the dollar of every barrel of oil is captured by the Venezuelan, by the Russian, by the Angolan, by the Nigerian governments. Typically, how much it captures is dependent on the prevailing oil price. But that means that, in other words, then, that the Nigerian state is able to capture a great deal of oil wealth. It might be $50, $70, $80 billion a year of oil revenues. And then, of course, those oil revenues have to be invested or distributed in some way. And all oil-producing states have a set of institutions to do that. Nigeria is a federal system, rather like the U.S., 36 states, and there's something called the revenue allocation process, which determines what proportion is retained, what proportion of the oil wealth is retained by the federal government, the local state, and the local governments. That's essentially the political economy of oil. And so apropos your question then of why did all of this oil wealth not translate into radical improvements in well-being for the average Nigerian, the question, of course, is, well, who gets access to that centralized oil wealth? Which is, to put it differently, oil will always be inserted into some type of political system. And in the case of Nigeria, when most oil came online in the 1970s, what that meant was Nigeria was then a multi-ethnic, multi-religious polity, which was highly contentious. And so the short answer to the question is that oil, rather than being invested productively or invested in institutions and mechanisms that would improve well-being, rather that pot of gold sitting at the heart of the state was essentially pillaged and captured by various political interests. Those political interest groups could be politicians, they could be military, they could be capitalists, but and they were often ethnic constituencies. And so much of that money then, and what the function of the state was as a result of its oil wealth, was trying to use that wealth and channel that wealth to key constituencies in order, if you like, to purchase a type of political peace, a stability. And the consequence of that was that the state became less a vehicle for development than a vehicle for, if you like, just shunting money to key constituencies. And you could see that in terms of Nigeria is typically ranked as one of the most corrupt countries in the world, but there are all sorts of ways that states have of allocating this money. And in that sense, then, you might say that the state itself was characterized by a series of deficits rather than state capacities. In other words, the state was actually a blockage to forms of accumulation and wealth generation and development. So that's essentially the logic. And in my view, I think Venezuela and Angola and other oil-producing states have their own versions of that. The politics, of course, will vary markedly between countries. But that's the essential contradiction.
Well, this may not be fair. It's a little bit off subject for this morning. But can you venture a word about the mess in Venezuela? Wasn't it not so long ago that Chavez was saying he could help out poor people in this country?
That's right. And he most certainly did. You know, just because the state, could be Venezuela, could be Nigeria, captures that oil revenue, and because those oil revenues are inserted into a ready existing political system, it doesn't mean, of course, that the rich always benefit. That's the Nigeria story. I've referred to it in the Nigerian context as an elite cartel, a group of powerful civilian, military, political, capitalist interests captured that wealth. But, of course, that doesn't have to be the case, and it really depends on who controls the state, what's the nature of the political settlement. And, of course, in Chavez's case, he came to power in such a way that he channeled that money not to the Venezuelan middle classes and the bourgeoisie, which had typically benefited historically in Venezuela, but he channeled it to the barrio, if you like, to working people, particularly in Caracas and the main cities. So, of course, now he may have done that in a way that was not terribly efficient, and I have no doubt, I'm not a Venezuelan expert, but I have no doubt that that money was corrupted along the way. But nonetheless, that was a political constituency that he wanted to address directly through investments in public health and so on and so forth. And, of course, as you might anticipate, that produced a ferocious backlash from the Venezuelan middle classes. So Venezuela, to me, is an interesting case precisely because the political situation there and the political leadership, the political settlement, produced a very different, if you like, revenue allocation process. And if you just to jump across the Atlantic again and look at Putin and Russia, right, there's a different political system, obviously, at work there. And obviously, Russia isn't entirely an oil-dependent state in the same way that Venezuela and Nigeria are, but nonetheless, oil revenues matter enormously. And again, Mr. Putin, after sort of renationalizing the big oil companies, you'll remember in the 1990s they were sort of privatized, and then we had the emergence of what were called in Russia the oiligarchs, the powerful oil oligarchy, which often were critical of Mr. Putin, and as you know, he then imprisoned a bunch of these guys and renationalized the industry, and then also allocated oil revenues to key constituencies in Russia. And that's one of the reasons why in the countryside, in the provinces, there's a great deal of support for Mr. Putin's sort of Russian nationalism. So again, the politics of this can vary among countries in terms of what happens to that oil wealth and how it gets allocated and to whom.
Okay, I should pause, Mike, for just a minute here. This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host this morning. My name is Cal Winslow. Our program is Where Are We Now? And our guest is Michael Watts, Professor Emeritus in Geography at UC Berkeley, who's talking with us about the politics of oil. Well, Michael, you also became involved both in writing and I think in activity in the what we might call the intersection of oil and ecology in Nigeria. Could you say something about that for us?
Absolutely. I'd mentioned that, you know, most oil-producing states in the global south tend to operate in joint ventures with the oil majors, with Chevron, Shell, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and increasingly with other national oil companies. And they do that through various types of legal and institutional arrangements. One of the consequences of that, of course, is that the oil-producing regions in these countries, in Nigeria, that's called the Niger Delta. That's not in the north of the country, the Muslim north. It's actually in the Christian southeast of the country. It's about 9 states of the 36 in the Federation is where most of the oil is located. Some oil is now located offshore in quite deep water. But that oil-producing region, of course, as you might imagine, particularly with a state, a government that is less concerned with, let's say, regulation or transparency or accountability or environmental regulation, less concerned with those things than just making sure that the oil continues to flow. Under those circumstances, as you might imagine, the environmental footprint of the oil industry is just extraordinary. It's often been said, I think quite rightly, that the Niger Delta is one of the most polluted ecological areas in the world. Some of your listeners will remember the devastating oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico when the Deepwater Horizon oil rig experienced a blowout. This was a BP oil rig, you'll remember. Sank, exploded and sank, and polluted vast areas of the Gulf of Mexico. Well, the total volume of oil spilled in the Gulf of Mexico, as devastating as that was, is spilled on average roughly every year, and has been for every year since the 1970s in Nigeria. That gives you a sense of the order of magnitude of this. There's probably been something like 7,000 to 8,000 oil spills in Nigeria since 1970. So as you can appreciate, the Niger Delta is a mostly poor and rural and agrarian region, and of course these oil spills, and then not only oil spills, but gas flaring, the burning of gas that's released at the wellhead. All of these sorts of things had devastating consequences on health, of course, but also on livelihoods. This ecological footprint was, of course, an important part of politics in the Niger Delta. And again, some of your listeners will remember back in the 1990s the emergence of this very charismatic Nigerian leader from the region, Ken Saro-Wiwa, who represented, in a sense, a combination of a social movement concerned with both human and political rights. Nigeria at that point was under a military government, but also concerned with ecological sustainability. And he led a movement that ultimately resulted in his hanging by the military in 1995. But this, in a sense, marked the beginnings in the region of the emergence of a type of set of political movements, not exclusively or not only around the environment and sustainability and the corporate irresponsibility of the oil and gas industry, and also the Nigerian state, incidentally, but also a social movement was trying to address human and political rights. So this was, in a sense, the 1990s, and the environment was a key part of this, marked a key watershed in the emergence of popular mobilization in the region, in the oil fields of the Niger Delta.
Two questions following up on that. First of all, in terms of the issue of the ecology, I guess we'd say, maybe you've been there a lot give us a brief picture of the Delta. What kind of a area are you talking about, say, pre-pollution, what would it be like? And second of all, listeners may not know about Ken Sarawiwa so much, and so maybe you could say a bit more about him, because he became an international figure of dissent and hope in Africa in the 1990s, and maybe a bit more on him.
Absolutely. Just the environment then. Maybe some of your readers are familiar with the Mississippi Delta. And the Mississippi Delta, of course, is in a very different part of the world, but it is a huge deltaic area consisting, obviously, of a major river and all sorts of complicated tributaries and creeks where it empties into the Gulf of Mexico. That's very much the situation in the Niger Delta, with the big difference that there the prevailing ecology is one of tropical and swamp rainforests. And along the coast, of course, there are typically mangroves, as indeed there are or were in the Gulf of Mexico. So it's an enormous tropical rainforest zone cross-cut by rivers and creeks and tributaries. And again, the Niger Delta, the Niger River empties into the Atlantic. What's in that region is called the Gulf of Guinea. So it's a magnificently beautiful area. Again, some of your readers who perhaps not traveled to a tropical rainforest areas will have at least seen photographs of the Brazilian Amazon or the Central African rainforest, very much similar to that type of environment. And, of course, it's not only an ecologically diverse, some of the largest swamp forests in the world, actually, are in the Niger Delta. It's not only an ecologically diverse, but it's an ecologically fragile environment. And to that degree, then, this ecological footprint of the oil industry that I've been talking about can have devastating consequences on the mangroves, on the ecology, and on the types of marine systems on which particularly poor communities in the Delta depend. So that's the type of ecology of the region.
And the people, Michael, the people, their way of life?
Of course, which traditionally here, outside of the cities now, have been largely based on fishing. Mm-hmm. Fishing in the rivers, fishing in the creeks, and maritime fishing, and small-scale agriculture. And in this particular area, this would be the growing of particularly corn and also tubers, yams, root crops, high starch types of agricultural crops. And this is an extremely poor and relatively remote area. There are very few roads across the creeks. It's difficult and expensive to build roads. Most transportation is by boat. And it's quite inaccessible and difficult to get to, and has some of the most, the most endemic and deepest poverty anywhere in Nigeria can be found in these types of riverine communities.
And so for fishermen, a disaster then?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons, we'll come to Ken Sarawiwa in a second, but one of the reasons why popular resentments built up over the 70s and 80s and into the 90s was precisely that these oil spills had devastating consequences on, particularly in the mangrove areas. And the mangrove areas tend to be those areas in which fish in particular tend to reproduce. And the consequences then on fish health and the consequences for the health of the entire Delta system was really compromised by these oil spills. So it's a very delicate, very fragile ecosystem in which the imprint of oil was felt, and that became the basis for these early sorts of protests, women in particular, incidentally, back in the 1980s, protesting the erosion of their livelihoods, that their fishing industry, that the fishing sector was being compromised. So there was a direct relationship then between these questions of ecological well-being, the oil and gas industry, and the first emergence, really, of popular politics from below. So, in a sense, Ken Saro-Wiwa, who was, incidentally, as you rightly say, became by the 1990s internationally known. He was an enormously charismatic man. He was very well connected in Nigeria. He'd served in the federal government, actually. But more than anything in Nigeria, he was known as a poet, as a novelist. He wrote scripts for a very well-known series of, I suppose, what we call Nigerian soap operas. So he was a cultural, public intellectual, very well connected, not necessarily terribly political early in his life, but himself was clearly mobilized and radicalized by what he saw going around him in his community. He was a member of the Ogoni ethnic group, small ethnic group, probably about 500,000 people, standing at the heart of the oil and gas industry. And he saw all of these consequences and was radicalized by it. And back in, even in the 1960s and 70s, actually, we have a record of the letters that he was writing to Shell Oil Company, complaining about the need for compensation and the consequences of oil spills and so on and so forth. But it was in the 1990s that he emerged as a major leader, and to that degree, he operated on a global stage. He got enormous support from Greenpeace and environmental activist groups in Europe and North America. He was a tireless speaker coming to the United States, coming to Britain, France, Germany, and so on, and really put Nigeria and the oil industry and the question of corporate responsibility, and especially the question of how, in that, at that time in the 1990s, the oil companies were essentially in bed with military governments. Nigeria was then a military government. It returned to civilian rule in 1999, but then it was a military government. And he called that the slick alliance of big oil and big militarized states. And it was that he was able to mobilize, just in part because of his energy and political charisma, a whole series of movements from below, which, alas, in his case, resulted in the imprisonment and hanging in 1995 after a military tribunal cooked up a whole series of untruths and his purported or alleged involvement in the murder of some other Ogoni activists resulted anyway in his hanging. There were desperate last-minute appeals from Mr. Mandela in South Africa, from the British government, desperate appeals after he was found guilty. But the then Nigerian president, Sani Abacha, decided to hang him. And it was a terrible tragedy. But in a curious way, it triggered a type of prairie fire, as it were, in the Delta, because what it did was to actually mobilize a whole raft of other political movements across the Delta. And it was precisely out of, in a sense, the death of Saro-Wiwa and his political movement that by the time we get to the 2000s, we see not only a proliferation of social movements, but increasingly, as he predicted, a turn to militancy. And by the time we get to the 2005-2006, what we see in the Delta are not popular movements from below, of the sort, of the nonviolent sort that Ken Saro-Wiwa proposed, but in fact a military insurgency. And that was an enormous shift, speaking again to the consequences of state repression of these popular sentiments.
And before we switch subjects here, Shell's complicity, isn't that a question in the Ken Saro-Wiwa case?
It is, and not only in the Ken Saro-Wiwa case, of course. One of the accusations made at the time, and there have, I'll talk about this in just a second, there have been a number of lawsuits around these issues, but one of the accusations that were made of Shell, and this was disclosed in part as a result of legal action, was that Shell, which was and is the major oil company operating in Nigeria, and was the major company operating in the Ogoni region from which Ken Saro-Wiwa came, it became clear that they were hostile to Ken Saro-Wiwa's movement. They were collaborating with the government in terms of preventing and limiting his activity and so on and so forth. And indeed, Shell was under considerable global criticism at the time of Kansara Wiwa's hanging for not putting more pressure on the Nigerian government to rescind that decision to hang him. But the larger issue that you're pointing to here, Cal, of course, is a hugely important one, which has to do with the types of complicated relationships between the oil corporations, Shell, Agip, etc., and often what are corrupt and sometimes military governments. And, of course, they operate in a way that's typically very unaccountable and is not transparent. And so under those sorts of circumstances, of course, many types of cases of political repression by governments often imply a type of complicity with dictatorial or authoritarian governments. But the fact of the matter is that these sorts of issues are very difficult to bring to trial. Some of your listeners will doubtless have seen the documentary having to do with Texaco in Ecuador, and the documentary called Crude, about the difficulties of having a case in which, let's say, a community or communities in an oil-producing region bring to trial accusations concerning, it could be environmental despoliation, but it could also be questions of human rights violations, where, in fact, local security forces supposedly protecting oil installations perpetrate abuses against local populations. It's very difficult to get these cases heard, and when they are heard legally, they're virtually always heard through the local court system.
Now, you testified in one of these big cases, didn't you?
Indeed, I did, and this I was just about to say, Cal, that this was, there have been, remarkably, a couple of cases that were not heard in local courts, where, of course, typically, smart lawyers representing the oil companies can keep these cases wrapped up for many, many years. In Nigeria, for example, it takes on average somewhere between 10 and 15 years for a case such as this in the local courts to be adjudicated. Well, peasant communities or local activists don't have the resources to continue litigation over that time period. So the case that you're referring to was one of a couple that were actually heard in the United States federal court system. I was involved in one as an expert witness. This was the Bowoto versus Chevron case. It was heard in the district court here in the Bay Area in San Francisco because, of course, Chevron is based in the Bay Area over in San Ramon. So, again, and it was an issue speaking to this intersection of the complicity of Chevron in this case with the Nigerian government and their responsibility for both environmental harms and, in this particular case, an incident in which local protesters occupied an oil rig, an oil offshore, in which then Chevron transported Nigerian military to the platform and proceeded to remove individuals violently, and a number of people were killed. That was the case that came to court. But that's very, it's exceptional because there aren't very many legal mechanisms, Cal, by which cases or instances of harms perpetrated by an American corporation abroad can be heard in the U.S. court system. These were exceptional.
Okay, I should pause again, Michael. This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. Our program this morning is Where Are We Now? Our guest is Professor Michael Watts. He's the Professor Emeritus in Geography at the University of California in Berkeley. And we've been talking about the politics of oil. Several more things I'd like to ask you about, and I'm watching the clock, Michael, but here's one just to kind of check up on. Whatever happened to peak oil? I think it was about 10 years ago, this station had a weekly program that focused exclusively on the subject of peak oil, and now that seems to have disappeared. I remember that you didn't exactly agree with much of that analysis.
Yeah, well, the peak oil debate is an interesting one, isn't it? Because obviously, it speaks to a type of logical problem, which is that non-renewable resources are finite. And to the degree that we know how much of a resource there is in a particular place or on the globe, and to the degree that we know how much of that resource we've consumed or taken out of the ground and at what rate, you can then predict that at a certain point that production of this resource will peak. There will be a peak oil, after which there will be inevitably, because of the finite nature of the resource, a decline. So my skepticism is not so much about that logic, but rather about the following. First of all, within the industry itself, there's an enormous debate over whether peak oil has in fact been reached. And by within the industry, I mean the following. If you take oil companies, oil consulting companies, oil research groups, and big organizations like OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, and the International Energy Agency based in Paris, these are all multilateral. There is almost no agreement on whether or when peak oil has happened. There is no consensus. There is a group of people who think that it was actually about 2007, which in global terms passed peak oil. But you can, even within the oil and gas industry, a company like Shell and a company like Chevron have very different views of when and whether we will reach peak oil. A number of the companies say, yeah, it's actually about 2025 or 2030. Some organizations put it way, way out there. And that question of why there's so much contestation and difference of opinion, of course, has to do with all sorts of things. One is how much oil there is, and how much oil is recoverable. So you can discover an oil field, but it's an empirical and technical question of how much of that oil you can get out. That's one question. The second question is that there's this complicated issue of how peak oil is shaped, and when peak oil will occur is shaped by the emergence of what we now call unconventional sources. Right? So an unconventional source might be shale gas. We've gone through the fracking revolution in the U.S. over the last decade, or reclaiming oil from tar sands. These are all unconventional sources, which is to say, until relatively recently, there weren't technologies capable of, in fact, extracting hydrocarbons from those resources. So to the degree that that has changed, and that has knock-on implications for when we reach peak oil. So all of that is to say then that in a way, peak oil is a type of complicated moving frontier that depends in some sense on these types of questions. And none of which is to suggest, of course, that we shouldn't be getting off of hydrocarbons for all sorts of obvious reasons having to do with carbon emissions and global climate change and all of that. But the type of debate over have we passed peak oil, or are we close to peak oil, is very much wrapped up with those sorts of discussions, which is what I was trying to raise. One of the heads of OPEC a long time ago had a very smart observation when he was asked about peak oil. This is Sheikh Yamani. He said, you know, the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stone. and yes, that's pretty much it. And so obviously one hopes that we're in a transition, although with Trump, it looks like we're into reversal here. But we were hoping, of course, we're in a transition to a low-carbon economy in which the dependence on hydrocarbons, and particularly burning hydrocarbons, is on the decline. But the peak oil question, of course, does have implications for many people, because to the degree that you think that it will take 20, 30, 40 years for such a transition to happen, then whether or not we have passed peak oil has implications, obviously, for markets and therefore for oil prices. So So that's why peak oil tends to get to appear in the press. Although, as you rightly say, Cal, it's of late, though it may reappear, of course, with the big push to expand oil and gas production under Trump, it may now reappear.
And catching up with past arguments, this is an opportunity we don't often have. We also talked last time you were on KZYX about another sort of dissenting or slightly dissenting position that you held, that, and that was about the wars in the Middle East. Now, these wars are still raging with atrocities on all sides. And you said they were about more than just oil. But many people thought we called them the oil wars. Would you bring us up to date on your thinking on that? Have you changed your thinking? Would you make any qualifications?
Yeah, that was the work that a group of us did here in the Bay Area, Cal, that you're a part of, called Retort. And the argument that we tried to make there, this was, of course, in the wake of the invasion and bombing of Baghdad, of Iraq in 2003. And the basic argument that we made there was a wide-ranging public discussion that operated under the sign of blood for oil, that in fact war was prosecuted in order to obtain oil. And in that book, we tried to make the argument that, of course, whilst oil is the most global, arguably, and one of the most strategic of commodities, of resources, and whilst the United States indeed consumes a very significant proportion of that oil, it wasn't entirely clear to us that was the primary, the sole, or even the primary motivation. It did indeed have consequences. The war had consequences for the oil and gas industry to the degree that the invasion of Iraq and the opening up of parts of the Middle East, for example, would have exerted a pressure to liberalize the oil and gas industry in that region. As you know, as I've just described, much of the oil and gas industry is really not a great exemplar of free market capitalism, understood by the fact that the nationalized oil companies, some of which in fact are much larger than Chevron or AGIP or Shell, if you look at the Chinese oil companies, for example, these are nationalized and state-owned and state-driven entities. And because you have something like OPEC, which is a cartel, again, the very antithesis of a certain type of free market capitalism, it tries to regulate output through a quota system in order to shape price. The oil and gas industry, in some respects, isn't a free market anything. And so to that degree, whilst the invasion of Iraq and the war clearly potentially had payoffs for the United States in terms of, as it were, trying to open up or liberalize this state-controlled system of oil and gas production, we tried to argue that it wasn't a primary reason. And indeed, what was at stake here was American empire. That was, should be front and central. And we referred to that as military neoliberalism. Mm. And in Bush 42 and the type of Rumsfeld, Cheney, Wolfowitz crowd, that type of neocon sense of wishing to export, as it were, a certain type of American nationalism. It seemed to us then that it was driven by a particular crisis of American capitalism and the need to, as it were, export or to expand the horizons of American neoliberalism militarily. It was about that project for which there were derivative benefits, one of which might have been increased access to oil. That was the type of argument that we were trying to make, rather than just seeing it as a simple oil, corporate power, blood for oil.
Okay, good. So, Michael, you agreed, I think, and I hope so, that I could ask you a little bit about yourself in terms of this program. And one thing I wanted to ask, and then I have one more question after that. One thing I wanted to ask was that you've thought a lot about the role of academics in terms of social issues. And I think it'd be fair to say that academics in the UC system, in the state universities, and the community colleges have been active in issues concerning climate change, and possibly with some success. Susanna Hecht from UCLA was on our last program, and she was thinking that California was actually doing quite well in terms of climate issues. I wonder if you could come in on both of those issues.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that we're going to see, Cal, in the Trump administration is that states like California, who've already made it clear to the Trump administration on a number of issues, not only environmental issues, that they see the world very differently than Mr. Trump and are opposed to many of the environmental regulatory rollbacks that he and Pruitt and the EPA are anticipating, that in light of that, they're going to oppose it. And I think one of the things that we're going to be seeing is that the invocation of states' rights, which of course has typically, over the last X decades, has been a Republican right, I think you're going to see in certain states a states' rights discourse become very central as a way of preserving or advancing, in states like California, their own very different approaches to not just environmental regulation, but to various types of regulatory authority. And to that degree, I think, you know, historically, Susanna Hecht, who you just invoked, is quite right, that in many regards, of course, California, even under Schwarzenegger, had a much more progressive set of environmental policies and a set of initiatives in and around global climate change, for example, than many other states in the Federation, first of all. And I think there's a powerful set of constituencies in the state that want to continue and expand that. So I actually think that if I had to sort of look at the future over the next Trump years, I think that we're going to see a lot more tension and a lot more effort to increasingly preserve what progressive states like California may or may not have done on the environmental front, and a very contentious politics between states and the federal center regarding the weakening or the dilution of environmental environmental regulation.
And can academics and students, the universities as institutions, play a part in that?
Absolutely. I mean, your listeners are probably aware of this, but, you know, shortly after Mr. Trump's ascension, as it were, there was an effort not only within UC, but within major university research institutions across the country to preserve data sets and scientific information pertaining to climate change that had been generated and posted often on federal websites and had been generated by federal research that the Trump administration actually sought to withdraw and remove from the public domain. So this is just one little example then of how academics were immediately mobilized, fearful of the loss of key information during the Trump administration. But the larger issue, of course, is that academics, most academics that I know anyway, obviously have their research and they have their teaching, which is their primary responsibilities, obviously, but use their science and use their research in as public intellectuals or in the public domain or in policy fields more generally. That's certainly the case at Berkeley, and it spills over, of course, into the student body and Berkeley students or LA students or UC Irvine students more generally. Are concerned about the way the world is. And so it produces, you know, a strong sense that universities and research, particularly given the type of post-fact, post-truth world that Trump has seemingly promoted here, then the types of things that go on in universities now have a greater salience and importance than perhaps they've ever had.
Okay, and on universities, Michael, you're wrapping up a career in teaching at the University of California in Berkeley. Could you reflect on that just for a minute, and or more than a minute? But when you first came into the university, it was closer to the era than it is now, when public education, including higher education in California, was highly esteemed and free. It's my impression that California was a rich state then, but I think it's still a rich state, and yet education is declining in quality, it apparently, and its higher education is expensive. Could you put your own experience into that, or tell me if I'm wrong?
No, I think you're absolutely right, Cal. When I came in the 1970s, you know, what was then called, still is called, in a sense, the Clark Kerr model of essentially free, world-class public education, which the UC represented, was still a type of living reality. Fees were still minimal. And, of course, that was the product of the UC budget being significantly bankrolled by state revenues. That world is obviously gone, and we've seen two sorts of things. One, of course, is the degree to which we now are not really a public university system at all, if by that you simply look at the types of revenues, the proportion of our operating budget that we get from the state. It's essentially, it's trivial. And the second thing, of course, is that in order to balance the books, we've seen historical increases, particularly over the last 15, 20 years, in tuition and fees in UC. So both of those things have happened, and of course that's gone hand in hand with the abolition of affirmative action. So the diversity and the composition of the student body has changed. All of these things, in a sense, have made UC Berkeley, let's say, a very different place in 2017 from when I came in the 1970s. And my last point, and of course that's itself, is an object of ferocious debate inside and outside of universities. And a group of activist faculty on campus and students, of course, have been promoting the need to actually expand state investment, given its enormously generative role in the state's economy, to expand state investment in UC, even though university administrations will often tell you, well, we can't go back to the good old days of the 1960s. Politically, that's not possible. You hear this all the time, but there's an enormous set of pressures now to rethink that strategy. And this raises my last point, of course, which is that if there's a big difference that I see in the types of, let's say, freshman classes. I teach big freshman classes at Berkeley. It is a big change from the 70s until now. It's not per se that the politics of the students have changed. That's not really the issue. It's that they are now fully aware of the fact that they are going to come out with a degree and be heavily indebted and will be paying off that debt in a significant way during their working lives. And that produces necessarily, for reasons we can understand, a huge amount of insecurity and a huge amount of anxiety, to the point now where families, working-class families, middle-class families, are saying to themselves, is this a worthy investment to spend this money and for my Johnny, Mary, Juan to come out with this type of debt, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $100,000, right? Does this make sense anymore? And that's the conundrum that public education is in right now. As the administrators say, we don't have a model for public education anymore. It's not sustainable. And so this is a real conundrum, and the students experience it directly, and of course want to get through quickly with as little debt as they can, often having to work in order to do that, with all the consequences of that taking them away from their academic work. So there's a real crisis, I think, in public education as to what, in fact, this original and wonderful, in my view, Clark Kerr model of an essentially free university education for all means in 2017. And finally, I just say that the State Assembly bill, isn't it 1356, which is currently being discussed in Sacramento, about a tax increase in millionaires of a relatively minimal sort would generate sufficient revenues to make a tuition-free education at the UC and Cal State and community college levels in California. So all of which is to say, these types of debates are speaking centrally to the very idea of what a public education means in 2017 in California.
Well, very interesting, and that certainly is something we should all be thinking about with everything else we have on our plate these days. Michael, thank you very much. This has been informative, as usual. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and good luck to you in the work that you're doing now. This is Cal Winslow. The program is Where Are We Now? Next time, 2 weeks from now, we'll be back, and guests to come include Loreto Rojas and Richard Walker. Thanks, Michael, and good morning.
Thank you, Cal.